This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger. And now, officially, good morning, world, as we come to you with our weekly Saturday visit here in, we're in Scottsdale, Arizona at the moment, but thanks to the magic of radio and Bob Ferguson, our engineer back in Chicago, twirling all the dials, we're able to visit with you every weekend here on the Saturday morning show. A lot going on this week in the world of agriculture and agribusiness. The 99th convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation in Nashville, Tennessee, for the first time in 26 years, a visit by the President of the United States, the last president to do that. George H.W. Bush did it back in 1992, but a good turnout for the Farm Bureau. I think over 6,000 members from around the country were in the Music City, USA, and of course, in addition to the president's visit, they take the time on the delegate floor to hammer out policy and where they would like to see the agricultural policy and economy move over the next year. Somebody emailed me and said, where will the Farm Bureau celebrate the 100th anniversary convention? Next year, in January, it will be in New Orleans, Louisiana. That's where they're going to celebrate their 100th convention and anniversary. So we'll be looking forward to that next year. But in the meantime, we do have a lot of activity going on because wintertime is meeting time for farmers. Outlook meetings and discussions of one of the topics we're going to talk about during the second half of the show this morning as Max Armstrong visits with his guest and talks about farmland values. Who is selling, who is buying farmland, and what about the future value of farmland? So that will be coming up later on in the show this morning. But as I mentioned with Matt and Roger, the decline of dairy farm numbers in Wisconsin is continuing. And so we're going to check in with John Onken, publisher of the Agri-Dairy Business Letter in Madison, Wisconsin. He tracks the dairy industry in America's dairyland, and so we'll get a look at that. All of that coming up when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. It's about time we turn to John Onken in the new year of 2018. We check in with John regularly. He is the publisher of the Agri-Dairy Business Letter and keeps a close watch on the dairy industry, not only in Wisconsin, but nationally. And John, the item that caught my attention in your most recent letter, the continuing decline of dairy farm numbers in Wisconsin, but not so much of a decline in milk production. Talk to me about that.
Well, I looked it up. The highest number of dairy farms we ever had was in 1924. And it's gone down every year since then. There were 177,000 dairy farms in Wisconsin then. Of course, they were all very small. And every year since then, they've lost from a high of 3,000 farms to this last year, about 400 to 500 farms left business. So we're down to 8,800 now licensed dairies in Wisconsin. And that's the lowest, we might say, in history.
You also pointed out how many are grade A and how many are grade B, and you gave an interesting reason why some farms are just grade B. What is that?
Well, we've had a great influx of Amish farms in the last 20 or 30 years, even longer. And Clark County, which is the leading dairy county in terms of dairy herds, is just loaded with Amish farms on the eastern side of Clark County. And so that's the reason why they don't, the Amish folks aren't going to very modern milking facilities. They stay in their small 12, 15, 20 cows. And that's the transformation from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania to Wisconsin has taken place over many years, and they've stayed in business to this point.
Well, I know two or three decades ago in my area of Wisconsin, the Kickapoo Valley, I know that there were quite a few Amish farmers that came from the east and moved into that area. And one of the first things they did was take the electricity out of the farm buildings on the farms that they occupied. Are they still using that type of power to produce milk and crops?
They use diesel power and vacuum. Yes, they don't use, I don't know when they were using electricity to milk cows, but there are maybe some exceptions, but by and large, they're small herds, and the kind of barn that I had when I was a kid on the farm.
Well, talking about barns, that's the other thing I want to talk to you about today, because I heard from an astounding lady who has written four 500-page books dealing with round barns. I know that you have read all the books. I haven't read all of them yet, but we probably had about three round barns within 5 miles of the Samuelson farm, and yes, they were interesting, and they did attract a lot of attention. What has happened, and share with me some of the stories in the lady's book, and first of all, who is she?
Her name is Jackie Dougan, D-O-U-G-A-N, Jackson. And she was a longtime English professor with the University of Illinois at Springfield. Well, her grandfather was a Methodist minister way back in the 1900, and he lost his hearing. And he didn't, I guess the congregation didn't want a deaf minister very bad, so he bought a rundown farm at Beloit, Wisconsin. From there starts the story, and in 1911, he built a round barn. They were in, that was the beginning, and then the next half a century, quite a few were built. And in fact, your home county, I believe, was the leading round barn county in Wisconsin, Vernon County. But anyway, because he was deaf, he kept a lot of records. He wrote a lot of things. His son went to college at Northwestern University. And they built this farm over the years, and the round barn was the title of her book, but it really was, it's about the people who were involved in the round barn, who visited there. Rockefeller Prentice was an early visitor, and he was the founder of American Breeder Service. The AI industry sort of had a start there because the Duke Dougan family were interested in better dairy cattle. And this lady has told all these stories in these four books about the people who came in, the people who worked there. They also ran a milk route in Beloit. And it's fascinating because they were running what would we call a field chopper in 1929 in conjunction with the University of Wisconsin. And I think most people think that field choppers began somewhere in the 60s or 70s, but they were doing things, and she recorded this, and she told me the other day, I did talk to her 2 days ago, that she's given all of these archives, boxes and boxes and boxes of records to University of Wisconsin for preservation. It's absolutely fascinating. You can pick up any of the books and start anywhere. There's stories about people who visited. And they also had farm progress days in 1961 on this farm. And I believe it's still a record crowd of about 160,000 people attended. They've never come close to that since. But you can get these. It's called roundbarnstories.com, and there's an order blank.
Well, let's get back to the numbers, because while the number of dairy herds continues to drop in Wisconsin, production of milk in Wisconsin isn't dropping all that much, is it?
No, it isn't, and I guess we can attribute that to the farm management of the day, the genetics of the cattle. The world record cow is up in a county where I was served as county agent now, and I think she's in the high 70,000 pounds of milk. And when I was with ABS, the top cow was about 55,000 cow, the world record cow. And the dairy herd average in the state now, I believe, is at 24,000, which 10 years ago, Orion, would have been unbelievable. But farmers are producing more, seemingly easier, with hired help and modern equipment. It's unbelievable. I don't know what the record or what it's going to be 10 years from now, but the production has not gone down. It's, in fact, stayed the same or gone up.
What about the price of milk?
Well, the price of milk this year is going to average 2017. The basic price was just about $16 a hundredweight. And that's one of the lower prices in the last 8 years. That's the second lowest. Other than that disastrous year, I believe it was 2015 when we went down. But the all milk price, they call it, that's for everything, is about $19 a hundred, which sounds unbelievably high. When I remember my father happy with about $5 or $6 a hundredweight, but the prices are high over the years. And we're producing milk, and unfortunately, the fluid milk market, people are drinking water mixed with crushed almonds and calling it milk, and any other thing you can put in it. And many of the milk drinkers are drinking less milk. And we have more cows, and we're producing more milk than we can actually sell.
Well, that's a hot number with me, because I'm sure you have never done this. I know I have never done this. I have never sat down and milked a soybean plant or an almond tree or anything else. To me, the use of milk by those products is simply to cash in on the high value level I think that milk has always had.
And now I notice that someone has developed through research a milk that is actually made the same as cow's milk, but doesn't come from cows. That's just appeared. I noticed a couple of weeks ago. I saw stories about that. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure why people just don't like dink milk and forget the almonds and whatever we got to mix with it. It's not the same, and it's not produced by people that love what they're doing and work with animals and work with their families as we grew up with.
Couldn't agree with you more, my friend, and I hope you have a good 2018, and we'll look forward to visiting with you throughout the year.
Okay, Orion, appreciate it. Thank you.
John Onken, publisher of the Agri-Dairy Business Letter, based in Madison, Wisconsin, joining us here on the Saturday Morning Show. We're at 24 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show. You know how I feel about 4-H and FFA. They played an important role in my young life that led me to a career that I've enjoyed for about 60 years. And this week, a couple of stories occurred that paid tribute to the FFA across the country. And here's the story. FFA members from around the country invited to connect with America's cattlemen and ranchers at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association trade show Friday, February 2nd in Phoenix, Arizona, right next door to where I am this morning. Through the Thank You Farmers Project, Culver's will cover registration fees for the first 250 FFA members and advisors who register to attend the Cattlemen's Trade Show using the promotion code FFA Culver's. Spokesman for Culver's said the trade show gives agricultural students an opportunity to network with professionals and to learn more about the beef industry. And we at Culver's are so honored to help these future leaders connect with others in an industry they are passionate about. FFA members are encouraged to wear their official dress as they attend the trade show, learn about careers within the beef industry, network, and enjoy Culver's fresh frozen custard at the Blue Jacket Custard Social from 3 to 4 p.m. on February 2nd at the Cattlemen's Convention in Arizona. The folks at Culver's have raised over $1.7 million in support of the National FFA organization and the foundation, and they're promoting FFA and career opportunities for these young people. So hats off again to Culver's for doing what they're doing on behalf of the FFA. That Cattlemen's Convention, incidentally, will get underway on January 31st and continue through the first weekend of February at the Convention Center in downtown Phoenix, Arizona. The other FFA event that I want to call attention to this week, while agriculture always played a part in the life of Arthur Daniel Knofziger, his love for FFA developed when he volunteered to judge career and leadership development events at the National FFA Convention and Expo. It was here that he judged the Ag Issues program. He found a love for FFA and what it has to offer students. In the Ag Issues program, participants research the pros and cons of an agricultural issue and then present their findings to a panel of judges. A team from each of the 50 states and both U.S. territories are eligible to participate in that event, helping students to develop critical thinking, problem solving, and formal communication skills. And so, in memory of Dan Knofziger, and many of us in FFA certainly are familiar with that name, the family recently donated $200,000 to establish an endowment to allow students to attend the National FFA Convention. So hats off to the Knofziger family for making that investment in the future of FFA members. Coming up to news time here on the Saturday morning show, and this week, in addition to the Farm Bureau Convention in Nashville, the Department of Agriculture issued the final crop production numbers for 2017. Some minor surprises in that report, and we'll look into the numbers of that report before we get to the 6 o'clock news here on WGN Radio. And we're here, Roger, and thank you for mentioning the trading holiday on Monday. Yes, once again, we'll have a four-day trading week on Wall Street and in the agricultural world because the observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday will shut down markets for that day only. So when we ended trading yesterday at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange, we will not resume trading until 8:30 on Tuesday morning. So keep that in mind. Right now we say welcome to Samuelson Says, brought to you by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I am Orion Samuelson, and today talking about the Ag-Gag Law back in agriculture. Back in February of 2014, Idaho Governor Butch Otter signed into law the Ag-Gag Law. The law was passed after activists had released a video showing workers at a dairy farm abusing cows. And the event a couple of weeks ago, the decision by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Seattle, reversed part of a lower court ruling that Idaho's ag-gag law was unconstitutional on free speech grounds. Writing for a 2-1 majority, Circuit Judge Margaret McCowan called the video ban a classic example of a content-based restriction that cannot survive strict scrutiny. She also said the ban on making misrepresentations to enter facilities. Now, when I was growing up, we called making misrepresentations lying, but now the court says no, making misrepresentations in order to get onto a farm or ranch, said it was void because it could criminalize innocent behavior. Suffered from staggering overbreath and was largely targeted at speech and investigative journalists. But the appeals court said Idaho could criminalize making misrepresentations, or my words, lying, to obtain records of agricultural facilities and to obtain employment there with the intent of causing economic harm. So part of the ban on that kind of activity is back in place once again. And, of course, the Animal Legal Defense Fund is going to continue to fight for those kinds of rules and laws. And Justin Marceau, a lawyer representing the fund, called the appeals court decision a mixed bag for animal rights advocates. It is a landmark decision because it upholds the right to record on factory farms and other private property. Until today, no federal circuit court had recognized that right outside the public sphere. So anyway, I guess you can lie to get on a farm or a piece of property and be legal about that. But I, in the many times I've talked about this ban on people coming onto farms without permission, I pretty much have always equated it to a family sitting in their home in the town or in a city, and suddenly somebody breaks in through the front door, starts shooting video because they suspect there could be child abuse in the home. How would you react to that if somebody suddenly walked into your home, started shooting video in that manner? It's a law that should remain in place. Farmers and ranchers should have the right to decide who is trespassing and who is not trespassing when they suddenly come onto property where they've not been invited. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. We're at 22 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show. Coming up, Max Armstrong and his guest will be talking farmland values and farmland sales when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. So what is happening with the value of farmland? What is happening with sales of farmland or ranch land across the country? Well, when Max sat down with his guest in the studio this week, this was Max's question.
So how is that market for farmland? Well, we thought we'd talk about that today with Jason Listina, who joins us here from Land Pro LLC. And they watch that situation rather closely. You also manage farmland, do you not, Jason?
Yes, we do. We manage for investors and individuals.
Well, I've been hearing of some of these prices, and I'd been hearing, generally speaking, that ag land market had softened, I guess, significantly, but it's not unexpected when you see this prolonged period of lower commodity prices. What are you folks experiencing as you watch it from Land Pro LLC in Northern Illinois?
We're still seeing the high-quality farmland relatively holding values well. There's been some cases where there's been some sales that have been very good, very strong. Woodford County, back in November, there was an auction that was over $15,000 an acre. That being said, though, the lower-quality PI farms, the farms that have some drainage issues, or that maybe have higher percentage of non-tillable land, yes, there's definitely been some softening in those farms. But as far as the high quality goes, we've seen it being relatively strong yet.
I'll come back to the high quality land in just a moment. But generally speaking, those less than perfect parcels, if you were to look across the broad spectrum of the Midwest, from the peak that we saw, how much has there been retracement in that average price, would you say? How much has it come down?
I would say probably pushing the 20%, 25% from the very peak.
Right. I've heard that. And so in some areas, those values would be down rather substantially, several hundred dollars an acre then.
Absolutely, especially for, like I said, the lower quality farms.
On the good quality, who's buying it?
Still a lot of local farmers are in the market buying. We do see a few investors or funds in the market, but for the most part, it's been the local farmers that have been buying the farmland.
So it's farmers bidding against each other in most instances.
Yes, that does seem to be the case.
Quite often neighbors bidding against each other.
Absolutely. A lot of times in these auctions, the property next door, there's only one chance in your lifetime to get it. And there's two neighbors and they both have the same thought that we need that farm. And they go bidding against each other. And that's keeping the prices up.
Have you sat in on any of those auctions, Jason, or have you talked to people who've been there to survey kind of what the attitude is among those who are gathered in the room? And what kind of a crowd is there often? Let's say it's one of those parcels, it's just real good farm ground. Will you find 100 people show up? Will there be 25?
It depends on the auction in the area, but usually, you know, there's at least 25, 50 people at these auctions. Sometimes if there's larger parcels, there can be more than that. The attitude is, it's kind of tension in the room. You know, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen and where the price is going to go. Everybody's kind of sitting on the edge of their seats and waiting to see who's gonna raise their hand.
When you look at some of these prices that are being paid, when you look at a more than $15,000 price, now this was purely tillable land or almost 100% tillable, was it not, that parcel?
That's correct. It was a very good PI farm. It was almost all tillable, didn't have any drainage issues.
PI, explain that to us. What does PI mean?
The productivity index, maximum of 147 and goes down. And obviously, the higher the PI, the better quality the farmland, the more productivity there is.
Even when it is productive, at these prices, is it profitable?
That's a big question. That's a very good question. And I think in some cases, possibly not. You know, if it's a property next door, you've been waiting your whole lifetime to get it. Some guys possibly might push it a little bit to get that property.
One thing that occurs to me is this auction would have been not many weeks after harvest. And it was a surprising harvest for a lot of growers in that region of central Illinois, as I recall from visiting with several. Their yields were surprisingly good, better than expected.
Absolutely. We saw some outstanding yields come in from central Illinois and across the board for the most part. Obviously, there was a few areas that didn't quite catch that rain when they needed it, and the yields weren't quite as high. But for the most part, across the board, yields came in surprisingly high. They did very well this year.
Even though that may have been just one season, and even though the prices were low, do you think that contributed to the relative bullishness or seeming enthusiasm, if not bullishness, seeming enthusiasm for this kind of an auction in that area?
Well, I don't think it hurts the situation any. Obviously, the higher the yields, a little bit more money they can make. I think this was more a case where they just had to have that farm next door and they went for it and got it.
Are some of these growers also acting to make sure that that next generation behind them has the opportunity to farm? In other words, are these some seasoned farmers whose pockets maybe are a little bit deeper buying this land in many instances? Are you seeing that, Jason?
We are seeing that. We are seeing a lot of father-son operations. And like you said, the father has the balance sheet and has the capability to take on more land and set it up for the next generation to follow him.
Are there instances that you're aware of where land has come onto the market because it was more than the farmer needed at this time? In other words, because of financial stress, because of lower commodity prices, have there been some instances where a farmer has sold off part of the portfolio and maybe rented it back?
We are seeing that very quietly, though. There are some farmers that have maybe got a little overextended. They have sold a parcel or two. They prefer the sale lease back so they can get the working capital and still farm the ground.
That is often a very private transaction, is it not? They also like someone they think is right for that land, someone they want to partner with to farm it?
Yes, and that's in many cases why you don't even hear about it, because it is very private and they would prefer to keep it that way.
Well, what about some of these outsiders who have developed a taste for farmland? In the past, we've been aware that there have been high-profile businessmen and women, individuals. There have been entertainers who've come in to buy some land. There have been, of course, the big investment funds. Are those folks at the table these days at all?
They are at the table, but they very selectively, especially the funds. They have a return that they want to meet, and with the prices of the quality farmland remaining high, sometimes they can't quite get that return that they need to make it work. So they're in there selectively. If they can get a little bit lower price, in some cases they've been going after a little bit lower quality ground where they can get a better price and get the better returns off of it.
Will they then anticipate making an investment to enhance the productivity of that land? Is a fund manager of a mind to invest in tiling, to invest in fertility improvement in a piece of ground?
A lot of them, yes, will put money back into the farm to improve it. It only improves the productivity of the farm, so their returns are better. And then when they go to sell it down the road, it will hopefully improve the price down the road.
The case I've heard you folks in the farm real estate business make over the years is that over the long haul, farmland does pretty well as a piece of a portfolio. Convince me of that. Tell me why I would need to have some farmland in what you would perceive to be a well-balanced portfolio.
I think the main reason is they're not making any more of it. And like you said, some of the larger funds, individuals are buying it up and they're holding on to it, so it's not readily available. And the appreciation of farmland over the last, 10, 15 years has been incredible. And we don't see that slowing down, maybe slowing down, but not going away. And also, we're seeing possibly some money coming in from the stock market. It's at all-time highs. There's some uncertainty there, the volatility there. So people are looking to invest in farmland that doesn't have the volatility. The land may go down a little bit in value, but it's not going to have that dramatic drop like the stock market will.
So some folks are taking profits out of the equities and putting it into land, you're saying?
That's what we're hearing, or at least they're thinking about it.
While we've seen a very bullish run of the stock market, we know that over the long haul there can be, along with those peaks, many, many troughs. And farmland tends to be a little more stable?
Absolutely. It doesn't have the volatility that the stock market does.
What are you hearing about the cash rental rates out there? Have you been talking to anybody? Have those, in fact, come down? That's been a very significant expense, of course, for growers. They've backed off, haven't they?
We've seen a lot of them remain the same as last year or slightly lower. A lot of the properties that we manage, we did decrease them the past 2 years a little bit. So we think they're in line, and we've kept a lot of them the same as last year. But in certain situations, we have lowered them a little bit.
Farmers have to be nervous about that, do they not, when they enter into an agreement, especially with commodity prices staying so persistently low?
Yeah, I mean, that weighs on it, and obviously their rental expense is a large expense for them. So we definitely sit down and talk with our tenants and, make sure that they're comfortable with that number and then they can make it work.
I am going to be visiting with a farmer. He's in North Carolina, and he has, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 45 to 50 landlords. He has a landlord dinner for them every year, and I'm going to be his speaker. And it occurred to me, and he does a very good job of trying to communicate with them. He has a newsletter, in fact, that's specifically for his landlords. Are there some things that strike you as a farmland manager that a farmer should be doing to try to keep that landlord apprised, whether the landlord is a retired farmer or maybe a big institutional trader? Are there some things that they should be thinking about to keep that relationship alive?
I think communication is just number one. Communicating with them, having that relationship, and then providing as much financial information as you can. The more open you are,
transparency
in the operation. And obviously, the farmer needs to make money. the owner wants to make money. There's got to be that middle ground to meet. And the more transparency you have and communication you have, the better the odds are that you can meet somewhere in the middle that makes both sides happy.
Some are also concerned, are they not, about how that farmer cares for the environment, or if it's animal agriculture, how they care for the animals. They want to know a little more about some of those practices, do they not?
Absolutely. And yields, I mean, a lot of the almost all the tenants these days have the, you know, can print out the yield information from the combine that shows the yields on the field due to variable rate, you know, fertilizer. And the more information you can provide to the owner, the better off the farmer is, and the better the relationship will be.
You hit on something that reminded me. There are a lot of different players interested in that data coming off the farm now. The partners that the farmer might have, and the crop input business, his or her banker, and then there's that landowner, that absentee landowner in many instances. Some of that data can be very helpful, I guess, in painting the picture, can't it?
It can, and we are seeing more and more of our owners requesting that information and wanting to see it, wanting to be more involved in the operation. And it also helps us, you know, I don't want to say educate them, but, you know, when we have to lower rents, We need to justify that. So with having that data, having historical data to go back and look on what the last 3 year yields have been, it helps us educate also the absentee landowner as to what's going on the farm and the environment that we're currently in.
Well, have you or any of your colleagues done any crystal ball gazing through 2018 about this land market? What's the general sense here? If commodity prices stay where they are, if crop input prices stay about where they are, what's the likely path then of the farmland market?
I don't think it's bullish. I think it's going to be relatively stable to slowly declining. One thing we're seeing is there's just not a lot of farms out there on the market. There's not a lot of quality farms out there right now, which I think is helping keep the prices up where they're at.
So for the demand there is, the supply is, I guess, just about right then, you're saying.
Yes, I anticipate there being a few more farms coming on the market here, a few more auctions coming up this month. I know there's quite a few, so it'll be interesting to see if the prices hold steady on the quality farmland.
Jason, thank you for coming into the studio with us. We've enjoyed visiting with you. We hope you'll come back sometime.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Jason Lestina with Land Pro LLC.
And they're located in Oswego, Illinois, and our thanks to Jason for sharing his knowledge of where the farmland industry is going. Well, we'll take a quick look at some of the numbers in the final crop production report for 2017 when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. It was interesting watching reaction yesterday to the 2017 crop production numbers. The market did not react sharply in the initial trading after the report was issued at 11 o'clock. But by the time the market had closed yesterday, yeah, it did react quite a bit, particularly wheat and soybeans. With wheat going down, soybeans going up. So here are some of the highlights of that report yesterday. The Department of Agriculture boosted its estimate of domestic corn production due to a record yield coming from bumper harvests in major growing states like Illinois and some of the smaller production areas. USDA also trimmed its view of soybean production, although the 2017 crop remained at record levels thanks to an increase in harvested acres. But the government's estimate of winter wheat planting at 32,608,000 acres, the lowest since 1909, but it was above a range of market forecasts. And that sent the wheat market down sharply yesterday, with March wheat ending 12¾ cents a bushel lower. But the big corn and soybean harvests that flooded country elevators and strained storage facilities said that both corn and soybean stocks as of December 1 were the highest on record. and corn production caused USDA to boost its 2017-18 ending stocks view for corn. Soybean ending stocks also were raised, largely due to a cut in the export forecast for soybeans. The soybeans, USDA cut its U.S. export outlook by 65 million bushels. Amid rising demand for shipments from top competitor Brazil, and it raised its estimate of the Brazil soybean crop to 110 million tons. And some of the other numbers, soybean stocks as of December 1, standing at 3,157,000,000 bushels. The corn stocks as of December 1 rose to 12,516,000,000 bushels. Wheat stocks, however, fell to 1,874,000,000 bushels in the report issued yesterday. So we'll see what happens, not Monday, but Tuesday, as once again we're approaching a four-day trading week. As I mentioned earlier, markets will be closed. The stock market, commodity markets will be closed Monday in observance of Martin Luther King Day. So that's pretty much what happened in a very eventful week. There was a lot of activity going on policy-wise and price-wise. And that's why we're here every Saturday morning to sort of sum up some of the highlights of the week just ended, and then a look ahead to next week. Will the market holiday Monday have any impact on prices? Well, we'll wait and see. But that's our time here this morning. Our thanks to engineer Bob Ferguson for doing his job back in Chicago. Thanks to you for listening, and Max Armstrong and I enjoy being with you here on this Saturday morning show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.